And welcome to The Morning Magazine, your front range morning news program here on Community Radio KGNU. It's Friday, September 14th. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Hannah Lee Myers. Coming up on today's Morning Magazine, for Suicide Prevention Week, we'll hear from a Parker woman who is launching a blog to provide support to others touched by suicide. It's a personal topic for her, as her husband died by suicide 2 years ago. Then, as we continue our week of coverage looking at the 5-year anniversary of the floods, we'll hear from a local resident who was able to ride out the post-flood chaos and not evacuate his house in the foothills because it was off the grid. He says his sustainable, low-carbon footprint house gave him resilience in the face of the natural disaster. We'll get a tip from EcoCycle on what to do with hard-to-recycle materials. Then Tech Talks rounds out this morning magazine. At 8:30 on Connections, should Democrats worry most that the Republican rule will continue, that Democrats will not win back the House and perhaps the Senate in November, or fear that Democrats will regain power and responsibility without a program to address the real-life needs of middle-class and working-class Americans? Talk it over with the chair of the UC Denver Political Science Department, Tony Robinson. That's coming up at 8:30 on Connections. But first, at 5 minutes past 8 o'clock, it's time for your local headlines. Here's Steve Miller.
The Boulder County Sheriff's Office requests to store long-range rifles in firearm safes inside two St. Vrain Valley School District high schools has been denied by the school district. The Daily Camera reports that the Sheriff's Office's request was intended to increase emergency response times. The AR-15-style rifles would have been in locked safes at Niwot High and Lyons Middle Senior High Schools. The rifles will continue to be stored in the school resource officer's vehicle parked in school lots during the day. Currently, St. Vrain Valley has one school resource officer per high school. The plan over the next few years is to increase that to two high school resource officers per high school and one at the middle school level. This will include an officer being assigned to Lyons, Hygiene, and Niwot elementary schools. There have been two community meetings on the subject, with those in favor of storing the rifles in the schools citing increased school safety. Those against it, worried about militarizing schools, adding to student anxiety, and the potential for collateral damage by bystanders. Protests are planned for tomorrow to coincide with the opening of the Rocky Flats Wildlife Refuge. Maeve Conran has more.
There are ongoing legal challenges to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service over their decision to allow members of the public to access parts of the site of the former nuclear weapons plant. A coalition of groups opposed to the opening will gather at the EPA headquarters at Wincoop and 15th in Denver's Lodo District from 1 p.m. on Saturday. Michelle Gabrieloff Parrish, founder of Candelas Glows, one of the groups involved in a lawsuit to keep the site closed, says that the area is not safe for public access.
We do have a lot of research and science on our side that says this is not safe. Also, this is a matter of common sense. So before the floods had happened, we were calling on the agencies to have some sort of oversight, because even if the testing shows that it's somewhat safe right now, that doesn't account for flooding that can happen, and then the flooding did happen. It doesn't account for a drought and a dust bowl or a dust storm that could happen out there that could be devastating to our communities. And, you know, a lot of this, it's good that we have the science, it's good that we have the research, and a lot of this is common sense. Do you think that a nuclear Superfund site and its buffer zone should be open to the public?
Yesterday, Congressman Jared Polis, the Democratic gubernatorial candidate, wrote to Ryan Zinke, the Secretary of the Interior, asking him to keep the site closed until next year to allow further testing of soil, air and water to be done. For KGNU, I'm Maeve Conran.
A U.S. district judge has delayed the first grizzly bear hunt in the lower 48 states in almost 3 decades. The 2-week delay on the grizzly bear hunt, where up to 23 bears could be killed, is in and around Yellowstone National Park. The Denver Post reports that the judge felt that serious questions remain whether the government acted lawfully in lifting the protection on an estimated 700 bears in the three-state Yellowstone region. There are two parts of the state of Wyoming's hunt, with a quota of up to 10 kills in prime grizzly habitat areas near Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks. The quota for outlying areas is 12 kills. Idaho's quota is 1 kill, and Montana has decided against a hunt this year, in part to demonstrate their commitment to conserving the grizzlies. And as of Thursday evening, the Silver Creek Fire northwest of Kremling in the Gore Range is burning over 7,000 acres, with some structures threatened. Pre-evacuation notices are in effect. As a result, the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment is issuing an air quality health advisory for wildfire smoke for western parts of Grand County. Areas of moderate to heavy smoke can be expected Friday morning in western parts of Grand County. This will mainly impact rural areas along and near Highway 40 to the north of Kremling. By Friday afternoon, smoke will generally move to the northeast of the fire. And in Front Range weather, extremely dry is in the forecast, with sunny skies through Tuesday, with highs around 90 degrees and nighttime lows of around 60 degrees. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
And the time is 8:10. You're listening to your independent community radio station, KGNU. This week is National Suicide Prevention Week, and Parker resident Jessica Seidner is taking this as an opportunity to launch a new website and blog, which she hopes will provide resources for people touched by suicide, an experience she herself went through.
I was married to my sweet husband, Tyler, for almost 7 years, and you know, like any other normal human being, there are definite ups and downs in marriage and relationship and just living life and doing life. And I had no idea to the extent of those ups and downs until one day we parted ways in the morning, like a normal day. He made me an egg white omelet, carried on, we went to work, and he never came home. He was missing for 24 hours, which was when we found the suicide note.
What was that like for you? Obviously, you'd gone through this period where he was missing, and then to get the news that he had, that it was a suicide. I mean, what was that like? I can't even imagine.
It was incredibly devastating, traumatic, heartbreaking, absolutely shocking. Again, knowing that, you know, just like everybody else, there are little ups and downs, but I had no sense at all that this would be the outcome of his life. It was a complete shock to me. And, you know, I'll be honest with you, we're just over a little 2 years ago that this happened, and I still wake up every morning and I think to myself, that was the worst nightmare I've ever had. And then I realized the nightmare is my life. And I have a choice, just like everybody else, every day to either kind of crawl up and curl up and be in a corner, or to figure out a way that I can use this horrific experience to hopefully serve others.
Now, you are using your experience. You've created a blog, and then you're talking about the impact on people left behind who are impacted by suicide. And we've actually done quite a lot of programming on this, the ripple effect that goes out and the legacy of suicide on those left behind. What was the impetus behind you stepping into that space to not just deal with your own grief, but to then use this as a mechanism to talk about suicide awareness and prevention?
Well, I would say I really wanted to create the space for open and honest conversation. What it is not about at all is shame or guilt or should have done this different or better. It's not about that at all. Instead, it's realizing, really simply said, we're all doing the best that we can. Life is hard, it's messy, and that's okay. But maybe if we're intentional about navigating those ups and downs together instead of isolation, we can help fight this epidemic. And I'm talking about myself as well. You know, this is hard stuff that I'm navigating through, and it is not pretty at all. But I feel like if I can make an intentional effort to be open and even embrace the messiness of what's happening, then there'll be a new degree of connection, a human connection that I can make with others just struggling with life in general. You know, I always say it wasn't the gun that killed my husband. It was darkness and isolation. And for whatever reason, he thought he would have to navigate this all by himself. Little did he know he had an army of people willing and ready to walk through this with him. So by being open with my blog and my speaking and the messiness of what I'm going through, I hope to bring light to that.
Well, your blog is called Own My Today, and you do write incredibly vulnerable personal passages about your own struggle and that day to day you sometimes just slap on a smile for the world, where really on the inside you say you're often falling apart.
Absolutely. And the word "and own my" actually comes from this recognition of I've got really serious public baggage. I was a very fortunate child, young adult, where I didn't really have that many huge challenges. And it occurred to me, I've got some major things going on. And you know what? I'm going to own all of that. I'm going to own my fears, my emotions, my devastation, my trauma. But at the same time, I'm going to own my new adventures and my joys and the moments of peace and the memories. So that's really where that comes from.
Well, outside of sharing your own personal journey, you actually have very practical tips on how to engage with people on this issue that can often be incredibly difficult for people to talk about. So give our listeners just a sense of what can be done. Particularly this week, we're doing a lot of coverage because it is National Suicide Prevention Week. What's a conversation starter that somebody could have this very afternoon?
Well, and to keep it simple, because I think that simplicity is the key, is how many times a day are we all asking, how are you? How are you? How are you? And I am just encouraging not only others, but this is really an outing of my imperfection as well, is that when I ask how are you, or somebody else asks, how are you, you need to really think about, are you really willing and ready to listen? You know, what is also your intent of asking that question? I bet I ask that question 200 times a day, but what is my intent, and what can I do differently to make the conversation more meaningful and safe, and whether it's body language or just my tone? And really, again, it comes back to listening. And I think that's the key. It's so easy for saying something like, how are you, just to be out of obligation or habit. But it's just adding that little intention, that little layer of intentionality behind something that we're already doing that may make a difference. And you know, we're all so crazy busy. But we also, if we have some intentionality and we hear something or see something in a response that makes that little, our little red flag go up in our gut, pay attention to that. Pay attention to that and dive in a little bit deeper. And we're all busy, but we can put things on hold to care and engage with others.
You can find Jessica Seidner's blog online at ownmytoday.com. All this week, we've been reflecting on the 5-year anniversary of the flood. People who were most impacted by it have shared their stories of the flood and their reflections on the recovery and rebuilding. This morning, we'll hear from two people who didn't evacuate like their neighbors because they lived in an eco house that was off the grid in Four Mile Creek Canyon along Wagon Wheel Gap Road. Homeowner Carl Hansel says that living in a sustainable way also provides resilience in the face of increasing natural disasters. KGNU's Maeve Conran spoke with Hansel and his former roommate, Misty Bergstrom.
After about, 3 days of rain, I finally realized that it had been raining for a long time and started hearing things, to be careful, watch out for flooding. all that. And we were up at Carl's house and basically watched the canyon get destroyed around us. Carl has his house set up in, for lack of a better term, a very sustainable fashion. He isn't, you know, connected or relying on city water or the power grid or any of that. So, I mean, basically the moral of the story is when the floods came, Carl and I's lifestyle didn't change a bit. Like, we're always careful with water and electricity and all of that, and so we were a little bit more careful than normal, but while everyone else was evacuating, nothing really changed for us.
And a lot of the evacuations were related to the fact that infrastructure was destroyed, i.e. roads, and so if people didn't leave, maybe in the airlifts, they wouldn't have an opportunity to do that. I mean, what was the situation for you in that regard, Carl?
So, yeah, the road did get destroyed, and I think we became aware of that Thursday morning when things really hit the fan. But people did evacuate on foot. It was a challenge. Like, it wasn't a cakewalk at all. It was like a scramble to get out of there. And I think Misty and I, we kind of explored that a little bit, but it's like, why leave? It's actually starting to get pretty pleasant up here.
Misty, you said that you were able to stay because the house had been set up in an off-the-grid sustainable fashion, so you weren't relying on those other utilities that had been, that infrastructure that so many other people had had lost. So you obviously had food, you had your own water supply. Yep. Give us a sense of the few days afterwards and what that was like for you all.
Well, I mean, I think Carl alluded to it. It was very peaceful up there. I mean, calm and quiet. And, Carl and I ended up, like, we did have to get to town eventually. So I know he had left one day on foot and got there. I think 2 or 3 days after, we built a bridge to cross the road on our bikes because we both, solely biked at that time. So we, built a little bridge so we could get our bikes out. And I think I was back to work by Saturday at the latest. And so we were biking in and out of the canyon.
And how long was that? Did that situation go on for where you had that road infrastructure as a barrier? I mean, how long did you have to bike as opposed to being able to drive up and down?
Well, we always biked anyway, so that wasn't a change for us. I don't know when the road actually was it drivable. Carl, do you remember?
My recollection is it was a good 10 days or possibly a couple weeks before they scratched in a road.
You mentioned that because the household had been set up in a very self-sufficient way, off the grid and sustainable, that helped you weather the literal storm. I mean, what is your sense about living in that way when we are facing more and more natural challenges?
It's a matter of resilience. It was so wonderful to not have to worry about electricity, although we did a little bit. We have grid backup via batteries, and if the sun wasn't coming out someday, we might have had an issue. But thankfully, after the flood, the sun did come out, and it continued to come out for successive days. So I'm thinking that was like maybe 3 weeks before we had grid power. So we lost electricity, we lost gas in the canyon, internet, phone. All those services were gone, but we had our own electricity. We had heat and water. I was able to get enough of a cell signal that we could do some Wi-Fi tethering and put a phone up in a window. And so we did have internet, which was very welcome at that point. That connected us to the world a little bit so we could kind of keep a finger on what was going on around us.
And compare your experience there then to that of your neighbors who weren't off the grid and didn't have those resources.
They evacuated for the most part. I'm aware of a few people like us that did stay, but I can't imagine it was very comfortable for them because they would have been without power and phone and internet.
And your thoughts then on this idea of living sustainably, because I know a lot of people make those decisions because of they want to reduce their environmental footprint.
Yeah, and that's what it's about for myself, certainly.
But now there's so much discussion around resiliency. Yeah. And in fact, there's a resiliency officer for the city of Boulder and so much discussion around how can we create more resilient communities, but also in an individual way. It seems that also when you live in a more sustainable off-the-grid lifestyle, you're inherently a lot more resilient in the face of natural disasters.
It's built in, yeah.
Carl Hansel and Misty Bergstrom sharing their experiences in the 2013 flood. For all of our coverage that we've been broadcasting this week, go to news.kgnu.org. KGNU is partnering with EcoCycle for a year-long series on zero waste issues. Here's this week's tip on what to do with those hard-to-recycle items.
Good morning, Boulder. Today we're going to talk about what to do with all of your hard-to-recycle stuff. Do you have a pile of stuff in your garage that you think, might be recyclable, but you also have an inkling that the folks at the Boulder County Recycling Center would be mighty unhappy if it showed up there? We know how you feel. If the county's guidelines say an item does not go in the blue bin or your curbside recycling cart, then you're right not to put the stuff there. What we call wishful recycling is a bad idea because it contaminates the materials that are recyclable at the BCRC and winds up in the landfill. So what's the answer? Well, check out the EcoCycle City of Boulder Center for Hard to Recycle Materials. We call it the CHARM for short. Since its founding in 2001, the Center for Hard to Recycle Materials has collected literally millions of pounds of hard to recycle items ranging from electronics to scrap metal and yoga mats. There's a $3 facility fee, which helps cover costs for staff and recycling equipment. The fee is waived for anyone biking or driving an electric vehicle to the facility. And there are fees for a few materials, such as some but not all electronics, and mattresses and box springs. Here's a short list of items accepted at the CHARM. Electronics, as I mentioned, plastic appliances, scrap metal, plate glass windows, plastic bags and bubble wrap, mattresses and box springs, bicycles and parts, books, concrete, porcelain toilets, reusable shoes and clothes, yoga mats, and more. In general, all of the materials should be clean and dry when you drop them off. For a complete list of items accepted at the CHARM, go to EcoCycle's website and type in CHARM. It's always a good idea to check the website before visiting the CHARM because we periodically add new items and fees may change. Why is it important to recycle absolutely everything we can? Because that helps get our community farther down the road to zero waste. Hard-to-recycle materials actually make up about 15% of the average municipal waste stream. And when we keep these materials cycling through the economy, we're creating jobs, conserving natural resources like forests, and we're reducing our carbon footprint. Got an item that's not accepted at the CHARM? Check out EcoCycle's A to Z Recycling Guide. You can find a link at the top right corner of our homepage. Our guide covers more than 200 items, and if it can't be recycled at the CHARM, then we'll give you other options. Thanks for listening.
KGNU's coverage of zero waste issues is supported by a grant from Boulder County. Now it's time for Tech Talks.
Right now is the best moment you ever know.
This is Tech Talks on KGNU with students from the Innovation Center at St. Vrain Valley Schools.
Estás escuchando Tech Talks con KGNU de parte de estudiantes del Innovation Center en las escuelas St. Vrain Valley.
Welcome back to Tech Talks. Today's episode will be about the biotechnology behind artificial embryos. Cambridge University scientists found a way to make these structures function to use them to research the early human development rather than using real human embryos. First of all, a human embryo is an unborn offspring that is in the process of development. Scientists found that similar embryos can be created in the future after using mouse stem cells tested in a laboratory. Artificial embryos would allow scientists to research and observe the mind-blowing development of the human body instead of using real human embryos. In Britain, it is illegal to keep a human embryo past 14 days when studied in a laboratory. Artificial embryos can help a scientist study past the 14 days. It allows researchers to understand when things go wrong. Scientists used mice stem cells to create a much simpler 3D structure, which resembles a mouse embryo, which was made up of two different types of stem cells and a jelly scaffold. The success of creating artificial embryos by using types of stem cells and mouse stem cells will make a different turn to the path of studies of human development. Scientists used real human embryos to study the human development, but with this experiment, it won't be necessary anymore. Rather than people donating a human embryo, scientists will create one.
You've been listening to Tech Talks on KGNU with students right now, from the Innovation Center.
Una vez más, estuviste escuchando Tech Talks on KGNU con estudiantes del Innovation Center.
And that does it for The Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Hannah Lee Myers. Now it's time for Connections, our weekly Friday call-in show. Stay tuned.